economy and governance. But today, really, my job is a glorified timekeeper. I'm here to share while three experts based here in Australia will talk much more about their thoughts, share with you their insights into the environment. So on this, let me just quickly run through 3 points to try to introduce the subject. I think first, the environment has become an issue which has grown from being sort of a very sort of niche issue, something that people talk and think about a lot. Among the world summits, the Rio summit in 1992 was at that time the summit that the greatest number of leaders ever went to. It's been bypassed since then by the World Development Goals Summit in New York for the millennium. But still, what this means is that more leaders than ever, more people than ever too, are talking and thinking about the environment. The second point I'd like to make is that in this movement from a niche to sort of broad mainstream, while many people talk about the environment, they're at times talking about very different things. A sort of caricature, a cartoon, if you'd like, about what people think of when they think about environment. It's sort of like, you know, it's an obscure bird or plant somewhere, and some guy wearing a sackcloth, you know, a hippie-looking like guy, saying, you know, we mustn't touch these things. And I think that cartoons aside, we all like a good joke, the environmental movement, it must be recognized to mean much more than that. Really, the environment is deeply connected with how human beings live, how future human beings will live, and how the economy and business run. And especially when we talk about developing countries, many of you are from developing countries, you see these tensions between environment, development, human society really there. So it's not about obscure animals, it's about really everything that matters to us, I think. The third point, I said I'd make 3 points, so quickly 3 points, is that I think that the environment today has become an issue where people can make differences. The difference when you stand in the supermarket aisle, what you choose to buy, what you don't choose to buy, can make a difference. The difference in how you make demands, consumers or citizens, makes a difference. And one of the key differences to me is innovation. You know, oftentimes the word environment is connected to the word conservation. And conservation is a sense of, you know, keeping things under a lid, don't touch it, don't disturb it. But I think many of the thoughts are going to be shared with you by the three speakers are actually about innovation. And I don't mean just technology, you know, not like sort of some laboratory somewhere is going to invent a device that's going to save all of us, but rather innovation, new ways of doing many things. Yeah, so those are my three opening thoughts. And my third task, therefore, is to introduce the speakers who will be sharing with us about 10 minutes each and then opening up to questions and discussion. And they'll be addressing us in the order they're sitting in. First, to my immediate right, is Dr. Julia Playford, Director of the Freshwater and Marine Sciences in the Queensland Environment Protection Agency. And this obviously is connected to marine wildlife conservation, the water quality, literally the water we're drinking perhaps, urban water conservation for this government agency. Prior to this, she was in the evolutionary genetics groups in this university. She's a member of various boards, including the National Biotechnology Advisory Council, the advisory panel for Griffith University's Center for Innovative Conservation Strategies, and an adjunct professor at this university again. She also has done a lot of work with NGOs, non-government organizations, including not-for-profit organization Rainforest Rescue, involved in conserving and replanting, I believe, rainforests in here in Australia, not in, you know, the sort of Indonesia or East Timor or whatever, but here in Australia. The second panelist would be Dr. Jim Sands, obviously the man between the two women. Jim teaches agriculture water management, includes the areas of irrigation, drainage, water resource conservation, and water reticulation. His interests overlap in the five areas of agronomy, that is the economy of agriculture, I believe, soil conservation, soils, and ecology, and his research is directed towards improving irrigation efficiencies, land-based effluent disposal, and basically how we can grow the very necessary crops we need to eat, and yet not run down either in quality or quantity our water resources, because we need both. We need the food and we need the water. The third speaker, Morag Gamble, has facilitated and supported the development of sustainable neighborhood initiatives in over 20 countries through a career as a community catalyst activist and sustainability consultant to local communities, governments, and universities. Let us say she's the one who takes these innovations, these ideas, and helps ground them into the people so that they understand how to make this work. And just before this session started, she was making me envious about her own community out in the coast here, Crystal Waters, which is trying to be a sustainable community and practice what they preach. She's a program director of the Crystal Waters College there, the manager of SEED, and SEED International stands for Sustainable Education and Ecological Design, and a director of the Crystal Waters Community Cooperative. And so that's our panelists. Those are our three panelists. And without further ado, could I ask on Dr. Julia Playford to please make a presentation. Julia?
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. Very pleased to be here today, and hope we can talk to you about some things that that may be useful to you in your future and currently in terms of thinking about environment and conservation of the environment. Now, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about shaping the future and being part of the cycle of improvement yourself, but the examples I'm going to use are all from marine and freshwater researchers. The point is not that I am encouraging you to be a biologist. In fact, we've sort of got too many biologists. What we really need is people who are interested in the environment and in conservation, but who want to be everything but a biologist. We really need people who are CEOs of companies who are interested in the environment. We need people who are accountants for companies and who are interested in looking at carbon accounting or looking at environmental accounting as part of the management of the company. We need lawyers who are interested in the environment and so on. We need politicians who are interested in the environment. We don't necessarily need biologists, but the example I'm going to use, because I am a biologist, is about what biologists do. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the work that my guys do, or guys who work with me do, looking at ecosystem health monitoring. And the ecosystem health monitoring is largely about a conceptual model that integrates scientific understanding with derived environmental values, and they are derived by consulting with the community. So you have the riverine system, you have catchment runoff, you have all sorts of issues. In the estuarine environment, you have sewage outflow and sewage impacts, and in the marine environment, you have soil disturbance and you have all sorts of other impacts associated with those runoffs from the riverine and estuarine environments. And the point is about maintaining the sort of values that we have at each of these levels. So the conceptual model is that we have on-land causal issues on the land. We have pressures and stresses within the waterways that are the things that we can measure about the impacts of on the environment. And then we have the impacts on the values and uses. And you can see illustrated in this model some of the values and uses that people have. They are about the marine ecosystem, the cute little cutie pies that are out there, the dugongs that people get wildly excited about, turtles, the fish people want to both see and fish and catch. But they are also about boating, fishing, swimming, and drinking water as well. So we have these whole series of causes, and the causes are a lot of them things that are simply related to a whole lot of people living in one place. So we have rural land management change from a whole block of green to little tiny islands of green within this incredible sea of urban and rural development. We have urban stormwater runoff, we have alteration of the flows of the streams, and we have point source issues. We have all the symptoms, which are the things that we actually measure: physical, chemical, water quality issues, physical form, and so on. And we have the impacts on those values of the waterways about which we are concerned. Now, this is really the essence of what I would like to talk about. And this is for water quality management in Queensland, the process by which we use. But it can be essentially summarised by: where are we now? Where do we want to get to? How does it differ from where we are now? How are we going to get there? How well are we going? Have we succeeded? And the whole cycle again of: where are we now? How are we going? How can we improve it? And so on. So scientists, my scientist guys, are involved in this cycle in a whole series of ways, and I'm going to talk about those series of ways. But everyone can be involved in any one of those points. Every one of you can be involved in thinking, where are we now, and where the hell do we want to be, and how are we going to get there? And that's what I would like to encourage you to take away from here. I have lots of stories about things that we do to look at that in terms of being scientists, but it applies to every facet of your life, and particularly every facet of your life if you apply this understanding of thinking about the environment over the top of what you are doing. That is how we really go about making change. Thinking about where we are now and where we want to be and working out how to get there is really the point. So we go through and we measure all those physical and chemical parameters. And one of the... don't read all the rubbish. Have a look at the guys on the boats. How much fun is that? I run 13 boats. I mean, how much fun is that? But one of the subtext of the whole thing is that in order to be able to go out in the boats and do all these fun things is that it has to have meaning for people. It has to have relevance for people. So we go through and we measure all these things: dissolved oxygen so that the fish can breathe. We measure conductivity. We measure temperature and pH and so on and so forth. We look at the sewage plumes and we look at the levels of nutrients. We go through and we look at some of the organisms that are out there: Zostera, which is a seagrass. We look at coral reef habitats. We get to go out and go snorkeling for work. How much fun is that? But the real issue is working out where do we want to be and how do we go about getting there. So we use the information we've collected through the monitoring process of monitoring all these attributes for many, many years to try and work out where we want to be in future. And then the scientists are involved really largely at that expert advice kind of level into deciding how we're going to go about getting there from that point. So we have put together draft Queensland water quality guidelines that are about where we want to be. It's not entirely the unrealistic where we want to be. It's not the we want pristine clear waters that are going to go running down streams looking fabulous and there will be no dams and there will be no use for irrigation and there will be, you know, so on and so forth. It's the realistic: we're here now and we'd like to move to here so that we have better water flows, we have better quality of water in the process. And then the key thing as a bunch of scientists is the monitoring of where we are now and how that relates to where we want to be. So we've got here an example here, and this is for the Noosa River, which is just north here, very fabulous if you get a chance to go and have a look. And we're measuring in this particular case chlorophyll A. The red line that you see here is the line that of where we think it is reasonable to be. That's where the levels of chlorophyll A should be. And you can see some of these points here are above that level. And that means they've failed for those particular, for that particular measure at those particular times and locations on the river has failed. And we do that on a monthly report for all those things that we measure. And this means any idiot can look at it and think, oh, gee, chlorophyll A is not doing so well, but hey, they're doing kind of okay for dissolved oxygen mostly. At the end of a month, At the end of a year, we go through and we really assess it. And this is when the media get involved. And this is when the change starts to happen. We go through and every river gets a report card. Some of them fail, some of them pass with flying colours, and some of them kind of do okay. And this is how scientists are able to take from where are we now versus where do we want to be and convey that to the public. There's a long process between letting it out, before we let it out, where we start working with people who are on those rivers that are the failing rivers. We work with the local city councils about how their sewage effluent's going and whether they need to upgrade their sewage plant. We work with industry on particular, on particular rivers and so on, to try to use this as a way not to beat people over the head, but to show them where they want to start moving and how to go about doing that. And that's one of the important things about being in the science area, is not to just use science banging it over people's head. As part of that cycle, we had a section where it's where do you want to be and how do we go about getting there. And some of the how do we go about getting there, the scientists make a contribution to that by looking at modelling, by evaluating possible management options. So, for example, we have an area under agricultural production and we are trying to reduce rural stormwater loads, which also means we reduce loss of soil and so on and so forth used for agricultural production. And we can model what are the likely outputs from changes that people make so that we can come up with scenarios that give us some advantages. And we can do it for a whole series of things. You know, if we reduce points, if we spend, you know, $10 million on a sewage treatment plant upgrade, how much of a difference will it make? But the point is not how much of a difference will it make just to the local stream, but how much of a difference will it make right through to the river. And this is this really illustrates just how those possible future scenarios will make a difference within the river system and within the Moreton Bay area that we are concerned about conserving. So the important thing is that we're here and we're using this sort of framework as part of the work that people do to have a look at where are we now. We go through and we monitor where we are now, how our river systems are going, where do we want to get to, how do we move forward, and how are we going, and doing some scenario modelling about the kinds of changes we should be making, and further monitoring on how are we going to where we wanted to be. How am I going for time?
About 2 minutes left.
Just very, very quickly, because I love showing pictures of turtles and things, is that we can also do that even when you do very detailed studies on species. So you can have a look at things, at the kinds of data you've been collecting for many, many years that you just look at and think, oh, my God, who gives a damn? And you can go through and you can use that sort of data to tell you how to make changes in order to get from where you are to where you want to be. So this is the estimated loss of green turtles, very cute and fabulous, green turtles, as a result of human-related mortality. It relies on 30 years' worth of monitoring work in order to put it together. And they put together this model. And they start the standard mortality rates for all of these human-related mortality rates. And they start the mortality and they see what happens. So they start the mortality, population absolutely crashes. They stop the mortality. And the important thing is you get a 36% decline in the population in 50 years. It takes you 150 years to recover. Oh, my God. And then you do it even worse because that was done at the lowest possible level of human intervention. And you put in the middle level of intervention and then the highest level. Well, the population's completely crashed by now if we had the highest level of human impacts that we thought we had. And so you start to look at the sorts of threats that are out there and put them into the model, adjusting them in the model. One of the biggest threats we have at the moment, because we've solved a lot of the fishing-type threats and trawling-type threats, is actually human hunting for food. So we thought about that pretty hard. We talked with people in the Indigenous community and so on. A lot of the issue about hunting for food in the Indigenous community is about maintaining cultural identity. Very important, but also not really going to happen if you run out of turtles in order to maintain your cultural integrity. So we started to talk about selecting no adults, only selecting sub-adults, and look at the difference it makes. We get a really significant difference here and a 40% reduction in the impact. So these sorts of changes lead us to have opportunities of looking at these sorts of scenarios, being a part of that cycle, give us opportunities to engage with people, be they local councils managing sewage treatment plants or Indigenous communities having a concern for the numbers of turtles that remain in their population, gives us an opportunity to start to communicate with people about where we would like to be in the future. And that's one of the most important things out of being a scientist in the environment area, is the ability to communicate with people where you'd like to be in the future and being involved in all parts of the cycle. So the point I would like you to take away from this talk is, yes, I get to manage lots of people who do really fun things on boats and get to go out and catch turtles. But apart from that, that whatever it is that you go about choosing to do, be it in an environment field or outside of an environment field, is take away from you the ideas behind this cycle. Where are we now? Where do we want to be? And how are we going to get there? And check as you go and progress each time. Where are we now? Where do we want to be? And so on, so that you are leading through a continuing cycle of improvement and concern for the environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Julia. Could I ask the next speaker, Jim Sands?
Well, from my introduction, I'm an agriculturist. My background's in agriculture. I'm a boy from the bush, as we say here in Queensland. This gentleman here is the 2002 Queensland cane cutting champion, and he'll be in later to wake up anybody who's gently nodded off to sleep. As agriculturists, we are the main land managers. In this country, 60% of the land is under agriculture, and we're the most urbanised country in the world. And that, and a fair bit of the centre of this country is used for nothing. So agriculture, whether you like it or not, is the main land use. We have to take a practical approach to basically managing a biological system to still provide a return on capital for farmers, to provide food and fibre, meat, eggs, etc., for people to eat, and we have to satisfy our increasingly urbanised population that we are managing the land in an appropriate manner. And we don't have government funds streaming in necessarily to help us out with that. However, we do know that the most sustainable agricultural systems are similar, or should be managed similar to a natural system. We need the biodiversity in there, we need to make use of the predators over the pests, we need a variety in our landscape, etc. So, in fact, agriculturists are fairly keen studiers of the natural system. Yes. What's the problem? Yes. It's pretty evident. We've been very clever little chappies, and we've tapped into a lot of energy, and we've manipulated the environment to suit ourselves. In fact, we've been so good at it, we've actually forgotten we're part of nature. And that probably is the underlying problem. Look at some of the essentials of life, and we'll just do a comparison between early humans and, say, Australian society, and probably what a lot of other countries try and emulate if they're developing. Water. Early humans had to actually camp next to the waterhole. They actually had to carry it if they were going to move away from water sources. Today, the cost of water to have in our taps, in our households, this country represents less than 1% of our total income. So less than 1% of our efforts to getting water. Food, this took up most of the time for early humans. Today, cost of food probably represents less than 10% of our total income. So we've come a long way. We do have some odd things, though. Shelter. Early humans who were nomadic could actually carry their shelter about. If they weren't nomadic, they could probably build their shelter within months, maybe a couple of years. Today, the average Australian family probably spends 30% of its disposable income on its shelter and will pay it off over 30 years. It's got very little to do with shelter and a lot to do with status symbol. In the last 15 years, the average floor space for a dwelling in Australia per unit person has doubled. Some main problems that early humans would have had would include starvation and disease. A couple of major problems for Australian society is unemployment and obesity. Imagine telling that to those early humans. So things are a little bit topsy-turvy. So how do we treat our land? As agriculture, we're in charge with the largest land user. And farming practices haven't occurred because farmers wanted to do it that way. They've occurred because consumers have demanded it. And what consumers have demanded is unblemished product all year round, and they last in our refrigerator for weeks. And they want it dirt cheap. That's what they want. So, how's agriculture evolved? Large machinery, using large amounts of energy to make it, large amount of other resources, large amounts of energy to run it, because energy is cheap. Long distance transport, so we can ship product from one end of the nation to the other. We can ship it from one hemisphere to another, so our consumers can eat summer fruit in winter and winter fruit in summer. We've had concentrated sources of nutrients and artificial fertilisers. We've mined islands full of bird poo for decades and then distributed them onto our farmlands. We've actually had to compete with the pests because they like these crops too, so we've used pesticides to protect them. We've built greenhouses. We warm them in summer, we cool them in winter. Enormous amounts of energy, enormous amounts of resources, and something like 50% of the agricultural output of this country comes from irrigation, even though it only represents less than 1% of the land area. So to grow these crops all year round, whenever and to secure the yields we need, we're using irrigation, takes water out of natural systems. So if society wants to agriculture to change, it's got to realise it's got to come from the consumers and accept that if we do things differently, the fruit might be blemished. Just about all the pesticides that are used in banana growing is all about controlling outside blemishes on the skin. It will not last forever. If you want a tasty tomato, okay, it will probably only last a week when it's nice and ripe. If you want something that you can buy after it's been shipped halfway around the country and it'll last in your refrigerator for 2 weeks, it's probably going to taste like cardboard because that's what it's bred to do. Resist all physical damage. You can't have both. It won't be available all year round, and more importantly, it will cost more because the current agricultural practices are really evolved by producing food as cheaply as possible. Our cities, obviously, because we're gregarious little animals, we've congregated and we've therefore concentrated a lot of resources. Once we've stopped growing, all the nutrients that we ingest, we excrete, so that's got to go somewhere. And all the things we use, they have pollutants and they tend to be concentrated. We also make very large changes to the hydrology of our environment. Julia was talking about, usually, especially in Australia, we position most of our cities on the coast, and so the bays surrounding those cities tend to cop the worst of it. But despite the enormous amount of resources that have been put into our cities, local authorities who are charged with looking after our cities really struggle to manage and this ecological footprint that our cities have done. Because they were really set up to provide services, but not necessarily to provide services for the environment. Now, a quick calculation is less than 3% of our total income, household income, if we would double local government's collection of rates. Can you imagine what local government could do if it doubled its budget? It could go a long way in dispersing a lot of these problems that we've caused by concentrating a population. So how do we get real change? Well, I'm a practical boy from the bush, and to be quite honest, I believe it's economics that have got us in this situation, and it's only economic incentives that will get us out. We do things for a while because we feel good, but at the end of the day, if you've got the choice of buying something cheaper and a slab of beer with a saving, your morals go out of the window, your feel-good problem, I reckon, can be settled with a slab of beer anyway, and you'll end up going back to buying the cheapest. Okay? Now, that's not to say anything against all the efforts of the people out there who are trying to produce products that are more environmentally sensitive. But we really got to change the economic incentive. As a bit of a soapbox of mine, I believe the incentive tax system to make our industries move in the right direction would be a big solution. You impose a 20% tax on industries that aren't doing the right thing, and you provide that same 20% back as incentives and R&D, et cetera, for that industry to move in the right direction, and they will move, because 20% in the commercial world is a very big margin. And personally, I have great belief in the commercial world being able to tell us and sell us and advertise to us that it's a good thing to do. Rather than at the moment, it's a good thing to buy a bigger house, a bigger car, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a lot more effective than simply increasing the resource costs. Recently, we've had supposedly large increases in fuel. It went up 20, 30 cents a litre. There was quite a political outflow about it, a lot of media pressure. However, interesting enough, I didn't notice the conservation groups jumping up and saying, this is great, this will be reducing energy use. So it's very disruptive to just keep increasing the cost of the resource, and we probably won't actually see a lot of change. What can you do? I recommend as young future leaders and people who are going to have an impact in your societies, be a little bit more informed about the real facts. We have global warming. Who's thought of nuclear power? Nuclear power, we don't want that. Really question it, why? A study in a coal mining area down in New South Wales found there was actually more radiation, leakage and pollution from burning coal than there would have been from a nuclear power station in the same place. So think outside the box and actually explore the real facts. Don't necessarily listen to academics or scientists, because even though we're quite often put up as an unbiased opinion, it really comes down to our own values and where our next research dollars are coming from sometimes. Support change with your pocket. We've got in this system because it's the cheapest way of doing it. If things are going to change, people have got to be willing to support people who are trying to change it and pay the extra. This is my list of avoid window dressing. Power companies who sell power also advertising to save power. In this state, we have a green energy levy that provides 2% of the total power by green sources. Everybody feels happy. It's 2% of nothing. We have water companies who actually advertise to save water. Think about it. It's all window dressing. What we call the NIMBY mentality, not in my backyard. And I think this is very important as far as developing countries and developed countries. We may say, well, we don't want to let our industries pollute our environment, but we're still quite happy to buy cheap imports from other countries, and we close our eyes to what they might do to the environment. What I call the affluenza. Okay, the disease most of the developed countries have. We've got to buy bigger and better and bigger and better. And I gave you that example about the size of the house. And the other thing is, try and avoid being ruled by the heart. I know it's furry. I know if it's green, it pulls the heartstrings a bit more, but it's only a small part of the total environment. Okay? It's what you consume, what you desire has probably had a bigger impact. So enough of my soapbox, and enjoy yourself the rest of the week. Cheers.